This recall was put on the ballot by Trump supporters, by national Republicans to really fight our Democratic agenda. And what is that agenda? It's an agenda that's about making sure that if you work 40 hours a week, you can have a living wage. It's an agenda about having universal health care. It's an agenda to make sure that we believe in science and we're fighting back against climate change. We just passed this historic budget with huge investments into health care and homelessness. Well, there was one other item that we had to put in this budget, and that was almost $300 million to fund this recall. And that's money that could have gone to education.
Yep.
That's money that could have gone to Medi-Cal and health care or to our food banks. That's money that could have been put to so many of the necessary and needed services.
Yep.
But that money's being spent on a recall because this governor had the audacity to lead in a time of a national crisis.
Well, shame on him. What was he thinking?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling there's something right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California, Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN and Eureka's KGOE. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Get Vaccinated Arkansas, Seattle's KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com, I don't hear anyone disagreeing. From bradblog.com, thank you very much for joining us today. No, Desi, no. Nobody asked you. No one asked your opinions. Hey, thank you for joining us for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Coming up, trying to make sense of this ridiculous GOP-sponsored attempt to remove California's popular progressive Democratic governor because Republicans can no longer win a regular statewide election in the Golden State. Are you trying to figure out how to vote, what to do? Well, you're not the only one. And as ridiculous as it seems, it's far more important than you may realize that you vote in this recall election, which is officially scheduled for September 14th. But most of our listeners probably have already received a ballot by mail. We will have a progressive's guide to the California recall ballot that may be useful for listeners in filling out that vote by mail ballot and getting it sent back ASAP, as California voters are now receiving those ballots in their mailbox and wondering how to fill them out. We will be joined shortly with some information and a suggestion or two on that from a progressive Democrat who is outside of the state party leadership structure here. And his strategic suggestions on how to vote are somewhat different than that that we're hearing from Governor Gavin Newsom and from the Democratic Party, both of whom, at least in my opinion and maybe in my guests coming up shortly, seem to be playing with a bit of fire in their strategy. We will explain why shortly. First, quite a bit of noteworthy news from over the weekend and again into today that I want to try to get caught up on a bit first. No, not in Afghanistan, where we've got plenty of elite military and political and mainstream media geniuses out there second-guessing their own 20 years of denial on Afghanistan as they flail about hoping to blame things on someone, anyone but themselves and all the other pro-war clowns over the past 20 years who have, despite all evidence to the contrary, actually thought that, you know, war in Afghanistan makes total sense. Well, they were wrong for 20 years, so why should they start being right now? Nicole Sandler sat in for us on Friday's broadcast and discussed some of those issues with national security reporter, longtime national security reporter, a good one, an independent one, Spencer Ackerman. It was an excellent interview, by the way. You may wish to grab it for free at bradblog.com if you missed our previous broadcast. More on that, I suspect, on another day. Meanwhile, this is shaping up to be, I've been talking about this for weeks, Desi Doyen, shaping up to be the summer when the reality of our worsening, deadly, seemingly unstoppable climate emergency may finally be hitting home for a whole bunch of Americans.
I'll just say one hopes that the series of disasters that we've been seeing here in the United States and around the world will help push people to focus and do something about climate action.
Unfortunately, it's literally hitting homes for many over this summer, as we're seeing. All eyes were and are on the damage wrought by Hurricane Henri, and then hurricane and then tropical storm Henri on the northeastern seaboard over the weekend. But before that, the monster storm that came ashore wreaked havoc, not just on the East Coast, but a completely separate system, I think, was already catastrophically deadly and breaking all sorts of record rainfall numbers in North Carolina first last week. From the remnants of Tropical Storm Fred, and then over the weekend, unfathomable record rainfall in Middle Tennessee, more than doubling the predictions of forecasters, actually tripling. Search crews worked through shattered homes and tangled debris on Monday, looking for about a dozen people who were still missing after record-smashing rains and floodwaters surging through rural Tennessee, killing at least 22 when I last checked. Saturday's flooding took out roads, cell phone towers, telephone lines, leaving people uncertain about whether their family and friends even survived this unprecedented deluge, with rainfall that more than tripled forecasts and shattered the state's record for one-day rainfall in some places. Emergency workers were searching door to door, with many of the missing living in the neighborhoods where the water rose the fastest. Desi Doyen, this had echoes of what we just saw days earlier in western North Carolina, and it comes as Tropical Storm Henri, apparently in an entirely unrelated system, has been pounding everywhere from New York up through New England. What do we know on the latest in both Tennessee and with Henri?
Well, just to put this into perspective, these two different storms, one on Saturday in Tennessee, one on Sunday in the Northeast, happened 1,000 miles apart, and both of these storms together broke all-time high rainfall records in some places. So it gives you a sense of just how big these storms actually were. It's about 10 people are missing in Tennessee still, including and sadly the deaths of 22 people that have been confirmed so far include two babies who were swept out of their father's arms as he tried to escape up a tree. The water rose
at Loretta Lynn's ranch, by the way.
Somebody the foreman at Loretta Lynch, Loretta Lynn, the country star singer, at her ranch, her foreman was trapped in the barn and was not able to get to safety before the waters swept him away. What's shocking about this is that as you mentioned, the hardest hit areas saw double the rain that this region of Middle Tennessee has ever received in its previous worst case scenario for flooding. And the reason why this is happening is because global warming, man-made global warming,
never heard of it,
increases the amount of water vapor that can be held in the atmosphere. So, for example, every 2 degrees of warming Fahrenheit that we see gives the atmosphere about 8% more moisture that it can hold, which means that it is able to dump that much more rain when it finally does rain. And to give you an idea of how fast the water rose in Tennessee, at one grocery store in Waverly, employees said that they stood on desks and registers and racks for the store as the water rose so fast from a creek that's usually 400 feet away from the storm.
Wow.
And they had to try to break through the ceiling into the attic because they could not get out. So that's kind of gives you a sense of how bad it was in Tennessee.
Yep.
And then we move up to the Northeast, where Tropical Storm Henri is now a tropical depression. Henri made landfall on the coast of Rhode Island on Sunday, but the impacts from the rain and the wind and the storm surge and inland flooding from the rain extended from northern Pennsylvania all the way up to Maine. About 100,000 people or so lost power at the height of Henri's hitting the Northeast, from New Jersey to Maine. And what was kind of funny, in a way, it's not really funny, but Henri forced the cancellation of that concert in New York City.
Welcome back
Central
to
Park.
New York, homecoming. Yes.
Sadly, it was literally in the middle of Barry Manilow's performance. I mean, they stopped him right in the middle of the song.
I know they did, yeah.
And it was really sad. And he continued it. You know, a lot of the artists went back into tents and they tried to continue working a cappella.
I'm trying to avoid a Barry Manilow joke here in this case. But yes, it was very sad that they had to stop Barry Manilow.
And to give you an idea that they actually stopped it just in time, Henri actually broke the historical rainfall record for Central Park that has been recording since the middle 19th century. Mm. So it was the most rain ever recorded in Central Park in a single hour, nearly 2 inches of rain in 1 hour alone. And that, of course, has caused great problems, not only with the power, but also flooding roadways, washing out some bridges, and flooding the subway and stopping mass transit as train tracks were flooded in the regional rain railway and also shutting down some subway lines.
You know, these numbers that you if you look at them, you mentioned 2 inches an hour in Central Park, you know, moving back to Tennessee for a moment. Up to 17 inches of rain fell in Humphreys County in less than 24 hours, shattering the records in Tennessee for one-day rainfall. 17.02 inches in the town of McEwen in 24 hours. I mean, the old record was 13.6 inches back in the early 80s. This just smashed it. We're not talking about, you know, usually when these records are broken, they're broken just a little bit. We are blowing away all-time records in when it comes to rain, these storms on the East Coast, when it comes to the droughts and the fires out here on the West Coast. It's covered in our national media, but how often, Desi Doyen, do they connect the dots to say, yes, this is the climate change that scientists have been warning us about for so many decades now?
Well, you don't see it enough, that's for damn sure. I will tell you that I've seen in the written coverage, in news articles online and in the papers, that they do tend to, at some point, eventually, maybe towards the end, note that this is what climate scientists have been predicting for years. But generally, on the news media online, I mean, on broadcast media, they are not covering it. I mean, of course, it's. I need to say that it will take time for climate attribution scientists to determine the exact fingerprint of man-made climate change on these specific two record-breaking events. But again, these are all in line with what climate scientists have warned we will be seeing with man-made global warming. And NOAA studies, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration studies, have shown that extreme downpours have increased in the United States since the 1970s, specifically in the eastern, along the eastern seaboard, 50 to 70%. So, yes, this is
just
climate change. Climate
just
change is here.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, climate always changes. You know, it's just normal. Nothing to worry about.
And, of course, the key is what makes it change. This is changing faster than it ever has in the geological record of the United of the entire planet.
Right.
And that is the problem that we're facing now.
And it's true, by the way. Climate does always change. It just used to take hundreds and thousands and millions of years to do so. Now it's doing so. And you know, just a couple of decades.
Right. It depends on what is driving it. And what is driving it now is humanity burning fossil fuels.
Yep. And I wonder if they're telling them that in Tennessee, in right-wing, deep red Tennessee. I'm wondering if they're explaining why the people at the Winn-Dixie or wherever it was had to climb out the roof of their store to stay alive. Anyway, thank you, Des. We'll be keeping our eyes on that, I suspect, as the week goes on and on tomorrow's broadcast on the Green News Report, no doubt. In some brighter news, at least for democracy and for public oversight of elections, from Friday, before we get to our discussion on California's dumb recall election, well, we had a bit of a win in Georgia. Speaking of deep red states that at least used to be deep red, a big win in Georgia against the GOP's abhorrent SB 202 anti-voting, anti-democracy law that was adopted by Republicans a few months ago, signed moments later by their very Trumpy Republican governor and former Secretary of State Brian Kemp, underneath a portrait of a slave plantation, by the way, totally coincidental. And when I say we had a victory, I guess I specifically in this case mean I, in one sense. As the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported on Friday, a section of SB 202 has now been struck down for the first time by a federal judge. The provision happens to be one of several First Amendment press freedom issues in SB 202 that was challenged by Marilyn Marx's Coalition for Good Governance, a lawsuit that was filed against the law by her organization. You may know her from the broadcast, where she is a frequent guest here. That challenge that that was filed by the coalition is one of eight different ongoing challenges to different aspects of this sweeping anti-voting law. It also happens to be one of the provisions in which I personally am the named plaintiff representing media in these particular challenges. I'm proud to be named in that lawsuit. As the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Mark Neese reported on Friday, a federal judge ruled against a broad ban on photographing voted ballots on Friday, throwing out a part of Georgia's new election law while allowing the rest of it to stand, at least for now. The decision is the first time a judge has invalidated a section of the 98-page voting law, which also limits ballot drop boxes, requires more ID to vote absentee, and, most disturbingly, allows the state government to take over county elections and, yes, change results, among other things meant to suppress the vote and, yes, steal elections. AJC notes that U.S. District Judge J.P. Boulay rejected the law's sweeping prohibition of photographing or recording any filled-out ballots, finding that such far-reaching restrictions violate freedom of speech protections guaranteed by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which is why I was delighted and honored to agree to lend my name as the plaintiff in that case. The paper quotes Marilyn Marx, of the Coalition for Good Governance, noting, quote, "The court's striking of the photography ban was an important first step in demonstrating that SB 202 is an overreach by lawmakers who prefer ballots to be counted behind closed doors, blocking the important oversight of the press and the public." The provision struck down by the federal judge had actually criminalized media and public observers who dared photograph voters voting and catching their ballots in the bargain. That's, particularly in the polling place when covering elections by the media or simply observing them if they were members of the public. It is almost impossible not to catch someone's ballot in Georgia polling places because of these huge new Dominion touchscreen ballot marking device voting systems that the state's current Trumpy Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, has forced all counties to use at the polling place. Coalition founder Marilyn Marx, she's a frequent guest on this program, as I said, she also has another long-running suit to block the use of those unverifiable extremely vulnerable touchscreen systems as well, as we've been reporting once again in recent days on this show, after the software used to really run all of the Dominion voting systems, whether it's touchscreen or paper ballots, was actually stolen by a Colorado county clerk and released to the internet a week or two ago during Mike Lindell's MyPillow Stop the Steal Cyber Symposium. That software is used in some 60% of California counties right now during this recall. That's why we've been talking about this over the past week or two. In any event, those touchscreen systems that they use in Georgia are the same type of systems that are used in large California counties here as well, like San Diego, San Francisco, Riverside, if you vote at the polling place. And they are very similar to the unverifiable touchscreen ballot marking devices that voters at the polls here in Los Angeles are now forced to use. So, yes, please vote on a paper, hand-marked paper ballot. A vote-by-mail ballot in the recall, at least if you're forced to vote on a touchscreen system at the polling place, drop it off at a polling place or a drop box if possible, rather than put it in the mail. But as to the small but substantive win, knocking down the first provisions of SB 202 in Georgia, as I said, I'm very proud to be the named plaintiff in that case, representing a number of First Amendment press freedom outrages that Republicans have shoved into that bill, making it harder for folks like me and others in the media, as well as the public in general, to oversee elections and to report on problems that are discovered during both the casting and the counting of ballots. Not that we ever have such problems in Georgia, right? The suit against SB 202 is much broader than just that one provision that we had a win on Friday. There are more First Amendment press freedoms and others, such as the election subversion provision, that is being challenged by the coalition as well, and the judge has allowed a number of those provisions to stand, at least for now, in this suit. The coalition had asked for early rulings on several of these SB 202 provisions because of upcoming municipal elections in the state. Marilyn Marks told me over the weekend that there is much more to come on both those other provisions and the ones that the judge allowed to stand for now. As I'm told, the coalition is currently deciding whether to seek reconsideration and or appeal some of those decisions. But, you know, with so far with so little good news of late, I thought the folks here might want to know about this small but important early victory for a happy change. It's also it helps to establish that our lawsuit in this case actually has standing so that it can move forward with the judge agreeing to knock down one of the provisions being challenged in the coalition's suit. So a small but important early victory for now. And given everything that's going on right now to undermine democracy and our country, well, I will take it. Speaking of undermining our democracy, that's exactly what Republicans are hoping to do with their attempted California gubernatorial recall, which is ongoing right now. I know a lot of you have already received those vote-by-mail ballots, are likely wondering how to vote on the ballot's two different questions, particularly the second one, in which there are a total of 46 candidates to choose from, one of which will become our next governor if enough voters vote to remove Gavin Newsom on the first question on the ballot, or if people just don't send their ballots in. So let's take a quick break here. We will come back with longtime Brad Blog legal contributor and former Veterans for Bernie senior advisor, Ernie Canning. He has some thoughts on that, as he recently wrote at bradblog.com what he titled One Progressive's Guide to the California recall election. That's next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. We still do have a soul, don't we? somewhere here in California. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The old idiom, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, comes to mind when considering both the transformation of California's Republican Party and the Golden State's gubernatorial recall process since it was first established by voters back in 1911. Both transformations, Ernest A. Canning noted at bradblog.com back in July, point to the need for California to either significantly reform or eliminate gubernatorial recalls altogether. He went on to cite the long history of the California gubernatorial recall process as the brainchild of Hiram Johnson, an immensely popular Republican governor who switched to the Progressive Party just after taking office. Johnson's progressive bona fides were already on display during his January 1911 inaugural address when he declared, quote, "The first duty that is mine to perform is to eliminate every private interest from the government and to make the public service of the state responsive solely to the people." Well, the Republican Party has certainly changed a bit since back then in 1911. If not the progressive ideals or the California gubernatorial recall process. As envisioned by Johnson, California's recall procedures were to have served as a form of bottom-up direct democracy that would act as a check against the corrupt influence of corporate wealth and power, which was then being exerted in the Golden State by the Southern Pacific Railroad. The state's recall provision, however, has failed to live up to Governor Johnson's lofty expectations, notes Ernie Canning, as we discussed previously on this program. Since 1911, according to Ballotpedia, there have been 55 attempts to recall a sitting California governor. The only successful campaign was back in 2003 when voters recalled then-Governor Gray Davis. That recall was a purely partisan affair made possible because the wealthy right-wing Republican Congressman Daryl Issa invested $1.7 million of his own money to fund a GOP-engineered professional signature-gathering campaign. Coupled politically with the disinformation campaign regarding power outages in California that had been engineered by the infamous, corrupt, and now defunct Texas-based energy company Enron. This year's gubernatorial recall against California's popular progressive Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, according to Canning, is being wielded as an anti-democracy cudgel by an increasingly authoritarian Republican Party, a party which morphed into an instrument of the very corporate wealth and power that Governor Johnson hoped the recall would serve to defeat. Ernie went on to highlight a number of long overdue common sense reforms for the state constitutional process, such as replacing recalled governors with their lieutenant governor. That makes sense, doesn't it? Quote, "The partisan incentive behind the Davis and Newsom recalls could be eliminated by revising the California Constitution so as to provide the automatic elevation of the lieutenant governor to governor in the event that a gubernatorial recall succeeds." Among other things, he notes that would prevent a repeat of the 2003 circus in which the incumbent governor was not afforded the opportunity to debate any of the more than 400 candidates who had lined up on the ballot to replace him back then. Nonetheless, the GOP's latest recall election is now underway at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars to state taxpayers, which, by the way, is just another reason why media and Democrats must stop calling Republicans conservatives. They are anything but. It's a brand name that goes over well, that sells to the public, but they are anything but conservative. Stop giving them the gift of calling them that. This year's recall circus includes some 46 candidates on question two of the recall ballot to determine which of those candidates will become the governor of the most populous state in the union if enough voters vote yes on question one to remove the governor from office. That means if just over 50% vote yes to recall the governor and 49% vote no to keep Gavin Newsom in place, a new governor would then be installed who might be lucky to receive about, 20% of the votes in this off-year special recall election with 46 people running all at once. Yes, the next governor of California, which if it was its own country, would have the fifth largest economy in the world. The next governor of California could be someone who received far fewer votes than the governor himself, the governor who would be removed from office in that very same election. There is, in fact, a lawsuit underway now challenging the federal constitutionality of that process, though it seems to me, at least, to be a bit of a long-shot challenge to the more than 100-year-old state constitutional provision. So what are progressives like you and like me, what are we supposed to do in this absurd election? Not voting, at least in my opinion, is not an option. There is simply too much on the line to not fill out and return the vote-by-mail ballot that hopefully all registered voters across the state have received by now. Joining us now for some advice, at least on both questions one and two, as he headlined an article at bradblog.com last week titled "One Progressive's Guide to the California Recall," is our old friend Ernest A. Canning. He's a retired attorney, a longtime Bradblog contributor, and during the 2016 presidential campaign, he was a senior advisor to veterans for Bernie. Ernie Canning, welcome back to the broadcast, sir. And I want to thank you, by the way, for your clear guide to the recall you published at Bradblog, because I know you slogged through every non-Republican, non-libertarian who is listed on question two of the ballot to come up with your recommendation for who progressives should cast their vote for. I know that was no easy feat in and of itself, because there was about, 22 of them left to look at, Ernie?
21.
And you slogged through all of them. So thank you for that. Thank you for your service. So listen, Ernie, I'm going to jump to part of your conclusion to your guide here. After walking through all of the candidates on question two, who declared themselves to be members of the Democratic or Green parties, or who offered no party affiliation, where you write about question one, whether or not Gavin Newsom should be recalled. As recent polling shows, incredibly enough, this is now a dead heat among likely voters. You write, quote, "Make no mistake, this recall election is a dangerous, naked, attempted power grab by a Republican Party, which knows no other way to try and win a statewide election in California. All residents should take the time to vote via a hand-marked paper ballot as soon as possible with a solid no on the first question in opposition of removal of Governor Gavin Newsom." Before we get to your recommendations on how to vote for question two, what is your argument for why voters should vote no on recalling Newsom, which would leave, if they vote no, that leaves the Democrat in place as governor, and it makes the second question, null and void, essentially. Why are you a strong no on question one?
There are multiple reasons. The first and foremost is, and I'm not exaggerating, in all the times I've been on the broadcast, this may be the most important that I've ever been on. This election is, with COVID out there, is literally a matter of life and death. If a Republican, specifically Larry Elder, or the leading Democrat that I've seen in a recent poll, Kevin Pathrath, mm-hmm. both of who want to make all COVID safety measures optional, mm-hmm. which essence is, basically what's going on in Florida right now. I fear, particularly for the children that are too young. I have a 4-year-old grandson. I worry for his life. It's so absurd when you think about the science of epidemiology, the case law saying that. And if you recall, I wrote an article recently about the fact that the legal case for compulsory COVID vaccines, all the way back in 1905, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a smallpox mandate by the it was mandatory vaccines for smallpox in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the court upheld that and rejected this idea that liberty somehow included a right to evade your civic responsibilities. If we can have people, the same people that don't seem to have a problem not texting while driving or driving with a seatbelt or obeying traffic laws, somehow it's too much for them to simply put a face mask on, even though you're exposing children who can't get vaccinated to this virus. That's just dead wrong. And the main thing that the Republicans and some of the Democrats that are running have criticized Newsom for with regard to the business shutdowns and the mask mandates and so forth, those are ridiculous. They should be asking themselves, all of the governor's mandates and his business shutdowns before we had the vaccine were based on the science, and they might ask themselves how many more Californians would be dead today if he hadn't taken the risk of doing that by doing that. The other thing I wanted to say about Governor Newsom, specifically with COVID, he was the first governor in the entire nation who imposed a mandate. He even did this before the federal government did it, on all state employees to be vaccinated. It, you know, it's a soft mandate where they can alternatively have to periodically test the COVID test. But he was the first one to do that. He's followed up with mandating that all teachers and school employees do it. And recently, the State Department of Health, under his leadership, is requiring that everybody that goes to visit a patient inside a hospital has to have proof that they've been vaccinated. Those are the kind of bold things that show that he's one of the best governors in the nation. There's no way he should be recalled. The other thing is, you know, when we talk about the Republicans in this state can't win a statewide election, haven't won one since 2006. They represent less than one in four California voters are Republicans, registered Republicans. In 2018, Newsom trounced his Republican opponent, John Cox, by 61.9% to 38.1%. And, of course, you know, last year, Biden just slaughtered Trump in this state by 5 million votes. The lawsuit you're talking about is based on the argument that it violates equal protection for the voters when the person who would replace this governor can receive substantially less votes, perhaps millions of less votes than the governor, and still be elected to succeed him. And that's the basis for the lawsuit.
Then the governor on the very same on the very same ballot. I mean, you know, you could have, I don't know, 10 million people vote to keep Gavin Newsom in office and 2 million people vote for Larry Elder and on the same ballot, and Larry Elder becomes the next governor of California.
God forbid.
But it's that's what we're talking about. That's the reason for that challenge under constitutional. What is it? Equal protection
equal
clause.
Protection. Yeah, that's the argument on the lawsuit. And by the way, Erwin Chemerinsky, is the constitutional law. I was reading his work when I was in law school back in the mid-70s. He's the dean of UC Berkeley Law School, and he made the same argument in a New York Times article. The problem is they're seeking a preliminary injunction. I doubt that they're going to get it and stop this recall. And I think it's up to every Californian. You know that the polls are based on what the pollsters think are likely voters. Well, if everybody in California who voted in 2020 and defeated Donald Trump by 5 million votes gets out and votes on this, which they should, this recall is going to fail, and it should fail.
Well, I don't know that it is going to fail. We will see. If they do vote, it would fail.
They vote.
Yeah. Ernie, we're in the middle of at least two crises, which I would argue that Newsom is governing responsibly, as you did when it comes to the COVID pandemic. And in both cases, Larry Elder, the leading Republican, another guy, Kevin Pathrath, who's the leading Democrat, apparently. In both cases, they want to do away with those mandates. But there is, and then there's the climate crisis, which, by the way, Larry Elder thinks is a hoax. And he also
calls it a crock.
Yeah, he calls it a crock. He also believes women aren't smart enough to vote, and he believes the minimum wage should be $0. But there is another major reason to proceed cautiously here. Democratic U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein is now 88 years old. She is supposed to be in office until 2024, and it's very possible that a replacement may need to be named for her. I hope not, but that could happen in the years ahead. And if a Republican is in office, well, that alone hands the majority in the U.S. Senate back to Mitch McConnell and the Republicans. In case people are wondering why we're talking about this on a national show, this has national ramifications. That alone seems like a good enough reason for progressives and Democrats to vote no on question one, Ernie. But let me get to question two, because we're short on time here. The state Democratic Party has this curious strategy for the recall. Frankly, it's curious enough that the Democratic Party has not spent any part of the last nearly 20 years that I know of reforming our ridiculous recall process after it was removed, install Arnold Schwarzenegger back in 2003. But the Democrats are now asking voters to vote no on question one, as you do, but also instructing them to vote for nobody on question two. Here's Gavin Newsom being asked about this on KGTV in San Diego recently.
Your message to voters so far has been to vote no on the recall and then leave that second question of who a replacement candidate should be blank. Why?
Because, this recall with simple no, you don't even have to get to that second question. So no and go. It's not just turn out the vote by September 14th, turn it in. Those ballots have dropped in mailboxes. Tens of millions of Californians received those ballots. I encourage people just simply vote no. Allow us to continue to work through simultaneous crises as it relates to these wildfires and drought and get this Delta variant behind us and move this economy forward. I want folks to know, I see what you see on the streets and sidewalks, the encampments, how dirty things are. $12 billion commitment to get serious about homelessness and housing affordability in this state. We're going to hit the ground running. We've got to defeat this recall so we don't set ourselves back. And that's exactly what these candidates on the other side want to do on masking, on vaccine verifications. They don't believe in a minimum wage. They don't believe in corporate taxes. Larry Elder doesn't even believe in climate change, calls it a myth, nor does he believe women are as smart as men. This is a serious, serious race. And I hope people just take a look at that first question, vote no, send that mail back, or rather that ballot back in the mail.
Governor Gavin Newsom making, two arguments there. One, why Democrats, why he should stay in office. But on the first part, they're saying, vote no and go. Don't vote at all on the second part of the ballot. Ernie Canning, is that a smart strategy?
It's an awful strategy. And I say that even though I admire Governor Newsom and I think he's a great governor. But that is really dumb. And I'll tell you why. As I see it, first off, he talked about the candidates on the other side of the ballot. He obviously hasn't done what I've done and gone online and studied every one of them. And he generalized things about them that puts them in line with, say, Pathrath or Elder. That doesn't apply to all the candidates, and particularly it doesn't apply to the one guy that I would recommend. And the guy that I would recommend is a Green Party candidate.
And there's two different Green Party candidates, and I want to underscore that Kevin Pathrath, he's this he's a 29-year-old real estate YouTube sensation. He's the leading Democrat. I already mentioned Larry Elder on the other side. Both of them would end the mask mandates in the middle of this pandemic. So helpfully, you go through the progress in your progressive guide to the California recall election. You helpfully go through, you make the case why that's an irresponsible argument to make, because the fact is, progressives, Democrats may hope that Gavin Newsom wins on that first question. But if he does not, do you really want Billboard star Angeline to be the next governor of the most populous state in the nation? Yes, that could happen. Do you want Larry Elder? This seems like an irresponsible, just a bad strategy. So sure, vote no on question one, but vote for someone, you argue, on question two in the worst case scenario. And to that end, you went through, and people can go to bradblog.com to read it, all of the non-Republican, non-libertarian candidates. You offered helpful information and background on each of them. And then you came to your recommendations for Democratic progressives. And as you note, interestingly enough, you did not recommend a Democrat, recommended all Democrats and progressives would do well to help the state avert a worst case scenario by voting on the second question for the Green Party's Dan Kaplowitz. Is that how you say his name? Kaplowitz? Not even sure.
I'm not sure. I think it's Kaplowitz, but it could
Kaplowitz. Be. Okay. So I will bite Ernie Canning. Why why Dan Kaplowitz out of all of those folks on the ballot on question two?
Well, let me give you that answer, but I wanted to say something real quick about Pathrap because I think it's vital that voters know who this guy really is. He is a 29-year-old real estate developer who boasts on his own site that he's a self-made millionaire who's got a net worth already of $29 million. His lack of empathy in some ways reminds me of Donald Trump, is reflected by his appalling proposal that the way we'll deal with the homelessness crisis is to just round up all these unfortunate human beings, have the National Guard round them up, and just simply deposit them in open fields. What's going to happen to them after that, I don't know. But I don't think much of him as a human being, let alone a candidate.
Interesting.
My choice. Here's a couple things that I use. Number one, I'm looking at educational and professional background and their ability to step in mm-hmm. to serve as governor. Should Gavin Newsom be unjustly recalled? He is a criminal defense attorney and a mm-hmm. UCLA law graduate, as compared to the other Green Party candidate who's a hairdresser. Just to give you, one example of where I'm going there. The other thing is that Kaplowitz, unlike almost all the other candidates, I considered it a disqualifier for any candidate, whether they have put a D on the end of their name or not, who jumps in and joins the Republican. Uses Republican talking points, basically propaganda, to bash Gavin Newsom regarding his handling of COVID, which has been stellar. And yet a lot of them are doing that to benefit. In the case of Kaplowitz, he is an ardent opponent of the recall. He's saying just about everything you and I are saying. He wants people to vote no on the recall. And he said the only reason that he's running is to provide a progressive alternative, prevent someone like Larry Elder from mm-hmm. pushing us off a COVID cliff.
Yeah, and I think that's very important. I'm going to point folks, because we're short on time here, Ernie Canning, I'll point folks to bradblog.com. They can read your full argument in favor of the Green Party's Dan Kaplowitz. I should note, you are not a Green Party member. You're a longtime, I think, dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, supported Bernie Sanders and so forth. And again, if you've heard about whether it's Pathrap, the leading Democrat, whether it's Larry Elder, whether it's any of this long 46 names on the ballot, Ernie Canning has done you the favor of going through at least the Democrats and the Greens and the refused to name a party affiliation candidates to give you some background on them and why, you know what, this is not a joke. This is damned serious. And, Ernie's recommendation for Green Party's Dan Kaplowitz, you can read why he makes that case. And I think it is a compelling case, and I think it is a responsible strategy to vote on question two, as opposed to the no and go suggestion from the governor.
Let me just slip in one thing.
Quickly.
And that is that if everybody who voted no on the recall, I see Kapelowitz as a form of insurance. If everybody who voted no on this recall also cast a vote for Dan Kapelowitz, there is no mathematical way that any Republican could succeed as the governor. And I think based on his ideology, he could work well with the Democratic supermajorities in the state legislature. So that puts him way above everybody else.
Thank you very much, Ernie, for that recommendation. Helpful guide at bradblog.com. One Progressive's Guide to the California Recall. Read about all of your favorite or least favorite candidates in that article from Ernest A. Canning. Ernie, really appreciate you pulling that together. I'll point folks towards you both at Bradblog and, of course, on the Twitters where you are Can the number 4, I-N-G. C-A-N-N, the number 4, I-N-G. Hey, thanks, Ernie. Really appreciate all your good work and your joining us today, my friend.
Thanks for having me on, Brad.
You bet. Let's take a quick break and we will come back. Our closing few minutes. We've got a follow-up, not necessarily a happy one, for a story that we have been reporting for a couple of weeks on this program. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. On the COVID front today, speaking of which, the FDA has given full approval now for the use of the Pfizer vaccine after it had been approved up until now on an emergency use basis only. No, that did not make the vaccine experimental, as many had falsely been disinformed by all too many, well, both right-wing politicians and irresponsible so-called influencers on cable TV and on YouTube and Facebook and perhaps most reprehensibly on the radio over our public airwaves. Now, many hope that this full approval by the FDA will increase uptake of a vaccine, increase the uptake rates, particularly in areas of the country which are being devastated right now by the Delta variant, with hospitals and ICUs at or above capacity in southern states like Florida, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, etc. I don't know that it will help, frankly, because that not fully approved nonsense was just part of a massive disinformation campaign. And there are plenty of existing and, yes, false and or misleading excuses out there to not take the vaccine being spread by the diabolical liars and or the dreadfully misinformed. But with the full FDA approval today, the Pentagon announced that we'll now mandate the vaccine for its 1.4 million active duty service members, finally. That's good. But if you listen to the Bradcast every day, you know we have been reporting on stories of right-wing talk radio hosts who have been describing COVID as a hoax and or making arguments against the vaccines. Right-wing talkers who have subsequently found themselves hospitalized in the ICU or dead after making false, abhorrent, deadly arguments that COVID's nothing to worry about and that vaccines are dangerous. Last week, we reported on two right-wing talkers who had died and three others who were still in the hospital, one who had been admitted way back in July, whose family said that he was in grave condition late last week, and whose brother said that he regretted speaking against the very real dangers of COVID over our public airwaves and the need to get vaccinated, though he only felt that way after he found himself needing a ventilator to survive. That was Nashville, Tennessee's Super Talk 99.7 WTN host Phil Valentine. Valentine, whose condition we've discussed several times over the past month or so, had claimed that he wouldn't die of COVID, but has since said, at least according to his family, that he wishes he had gotten a vaccine. though he only made that claim after he found himself needing a ventilator to survive. He wishes he had got the vaccine, says his family, at least when they released the statement asking for prayers and saying that he hoped to soon get on the radio to personally encourage his listeners to get vaccinated. Back in December on his blog, Phil Valentine wrote, "What are the odds of my getting COVID? They're pretty low. What are the odds of my dying from COVID if I do get it? Probably way less than 1%. Why would I risk getting a heart attack or paralysis by getting the vaccine?" He misinformed listeners. He mocked the need for vaccines and for masking. He wrote and performed a song lampooning vaccinations called The Vax Man, which was a parody of the Beatles song Taxman. His misinformation over our public airwaves likely had an impact. Tennessee has one of the worst vaccination rates in the nation, with just over 40% of the eligible populace fully vaccinated in the state. Well, after more than a month of hospitalization, Phil Valentine, a prominent voice not only on the public airwaves in Nashville for decades, but also across the country. His show was syndicated nationally. Phil Valentine died on what would reportedly have been his 62nd birthday over the weekend. His flagship station in Nashville reported, quote, "We are saddened to report that our host and friend Phil Valentine has passed away. He becomes at least the third anti-vaccine right-wing talker to die from COVID." Tennessee's U.S. Senator Marsha Blackburn tweeted out her condolences. So did the governor. None of them mentioned that he died from COVID. Got to get out. My thanks to my guest today, Ernie Canning, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, my board operator, Federico Garcia, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. You can drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I'm simply The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here again tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.